Thanks for the introduction. So this morning I'm going to be talking about how class standards have been integrated into a statewide health disparities reduction initiative in Massachusetts. So we already went through the disclosure. I'm going to be starting with some background about the Massachusetts Department of Public Health, or MDPH, Health Disparities Reduction Grant Program, and then I'm going to go through three case studies of how specific grantees have implemented class standards into their work. And then I'll conclude with some common themes among the three case studies. So just to give some context about health disparities in Massachusetts before we start, this figure shows prevalence rates for a few different health conditions for some different racial and ethnic groups. And you can see that for some of these conditions, there are some striking differences in the rates across these different subpopulations. So just as an example, looking at the rate of overweight and obesity, you can see that the rate is highest for the black population, followed by the Hispanic population, and then lowest for the Asian population. So to address health disparities like these, in 2007, MDPH launched an initiative called the Reduction of Racial and Ethnic Health Disparities Initiative. And an important piece of this was that 20 organizations throughout the state were given funds to work on health disparities reduction within their own communities. These grantees span a number of different types of organizations, from CBOs to public health departments to universities. And their work is primarily focused in three main priority areas: social determinants of health, workforce development, and then access to health care. The grantees also target health disparities at a number of different levels, ranging from individual interventions all the way up to the level of state and local policy. MDPH has really placed a strong emphasis on capacity building and shared learning among the grantees, and to facilitate this, they work with the Institute for Community Health, which is where I'm from, to offer technical assistance to the grantees. The Institute for Community Health, or ICH, was founded by three different healthcare systems in Massachusetts, and we work with a number of different organizations in the state to improve community health through a variety of services, all emphasizing participatory methods and community engagement. For this particular project, we offer technical assistance to the grantees in evaluation, dissemination, and cultural competence in class. So over the last 2 years in particular, MDPH has really strongly emphasized that the grantees integrate the National Culturally and Linguistically Appropriate Services Standards, or the CLASS standards, into their work. As some of you may know, the CLASS standards were developed by the Office of Minority Health in 2000, and they were just recently revised a few months ago. There are 15 standards. They're organized in three main categories. And really what they do is give a framework and a set of guidelines that can help organizations meet the needs of all the individuals that they serve. So the CLASS standards are broad. In terms of implementing them, it can go in any number of directions depending on the needs of a specific population. So what I'm going to do is go through three examples of how specific programs have really taken these standards and incorporated them into their work. I'm going to start with the Edward M. Kennedy, or EMK, Community Health Center and the work they've done around collecting race, ethnicity, and language data. EMK is a community health center that has locations in Worcester and Framingham, Massachusetts. They offer a range of services from primary care to specialty care, and they serve over 24,000 patients each year. They have really embraced cultural competence in class. They have a health equity and cultural competence team in-house that really works to target these issues. And they've especially put a lot of work into addressing class standard 11, which is to collect and maintain accurate and reliable demographic data. So they've really done a lot of work to do comprehensive collection of race, language, and ethnicity data from not just their patients, but also their staff. And the goals of these efforts are first to get a deep understanding of the different populations they're serving, make sure that they can identify health disparities that might be occurring in their populations, and also understand how well their staff reflect the patient population that they serve. So before really launching the data collection effort, they started with a broad training for all their staff. And the purpose of this training was to make sure the staff understood why they were going to be collecting this new data, and also how important it is that patients self-identify this information. And now that this work has been ongoing for a couple years, all new registration staff are trained by their supervisors on the same material to make sure that the staff as a whole is always up to date on this training. They also did a patient education campaign in which they used an adapted version of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation We Ask Because We Care poster. The version they adapted is shown here. The purpose of the patient education was to make sure patients knew why they were going to suddenly be asked these different questions, and that they understood what the data would be used for. For collecting patient data, EMK uses a paper questionnaire that's handed out by registration staff. So the staff gives it to the patient when they come in. The patient fills it out on their own and then hands it back. And then the registration staff person enters it into the electronic medical record. They do have this questionnaire in multiple languages if needed. And if there's a rare language that they don't have the questionnaire in, they have interpreters assist with the process. To make sure that this data was collected really consistently and comprehensively, they've made the race, ethnicity, and language fields required in the electronic medical record, so they have to be filled in. As for collecting staff data, they have a separate form that they use. They designed it themselves, and they made sure that the data fields and the main questions in the staff form align with the patient questionnaire so that the data they're collecting can be compared at the end. And for staff, completion of this form is optional. So within about 2 years of starting this work, EMK has now gotten to the point where 99% of their patient records include this race, ethnicity, and language data. And even though their staff form is optional, they've found that they've been able to get an 80 to 90% completion rate for staff. By collecting this information from their staff, they've found their staff speaks collectively 30 languages, many of which overlap with the languages commonly spoken by patients, and that about 3/4 of their staff are at least bilingual. They've also used the data to stratify some of their patient outcomes by race, ethnicity, and language. By doing this, they found that there was a disparity in compliance for well-child visits for, in particular, the Burmese, Bhutanese, and Arabic-speaking populations. And with that information, they went into the community, spoke to groups that serve these populations to learn more about potential reasons for this issue. They designed an intervention, and now further data analysis has shown they've been able to eliminate this disparity. There are several best practices that have come out of their work. First, whenever possible, collect granular ethnicity data. Broad categories often just aren't sufficient to describe very diverse populations, and in some cases, broader categories can actually mask important disparities. In this particular example, they wouldn't have been able to identify the specific disparities in the Burmese and Bhutanese children without collecting that kind of very specific ethnicity information. EMK also recommends that as a starting point, you define what diversity means for your organization, whether it's language or race, ethnicity, gender, anything else, and then measure it not only for your clients or patients, but also for staff, board members, or any other groups that might be of interest. It's also important to work with community groups and really try and learn about the diversity of your community in depth in a way that goes beyond just collecting statistics. And then finally, make sure the data are used. So going beyond just collecting race, ethnicity, and language information, using it to identify disparities and measuring change. The next case study comes from the Family Van, which is a mobile health clinic that delivers screening and prevention activities to 6 different Boston neighborhoods. The Family Van serves about 2,400 different clients each year. These are mostly minority patients, and about 1/3 of them are limited English proficient. They also serve large numbers of low-income clients, with about 1/3 of their client population being unemployed. So Family Van has really done a lot around Class Standard 3, which is to recruit, promote, and support a culturally and linguistically diverse workforce. So the initiative that they've implemented, they call the Knowledgeable Neighbor Model, and it involves using a diverse, multilingual staff team to provide culturally competent care to their clients. The goals of this model are first to make sure that they're really able to reach and retain their minority and LEP clients, make sure that there's trust being built between the staff and the clients that they serve, and increase access to preventative services for vulnerable populations. So in order to really recruit a diverse workforce, the Family Van employs a number of strategies. First, the job opportunities to join their team are posted on websites that are targeted at minority job seekers or networking sites that target diverse populations. They also do outreach on LinkedIn to specific professional groups that also are related to diverse or minority populations. And they've made a point to always consider their staff diversity as a kind of final checkpoint before they make their hiring decisions. In addition to this, to supplement their staff, they work with some collaborating agencies, such as the Multicultural AIDS Coalition, who actually provide them with some part-time staff that have particular language skills that can supplement their full-time staff team. And then to ensure that their staff as a whole are receiving supports around cultural competence, they've incorporated some discussions into their staff meetings in which their staff will do a debrief on real situations or real challenges that they've had interacting with their diverse populations. And it gives them a chance to get some feedback, talk as a group, and just receive some supports around these issues. The Family Van also supplements their workforce by utilizing a large volunteer program. For their volunteers, they do recruitment through pre-med societies as well as minority students' associations at local universities and community colleges. They also do very rigorous tracking of race, ethnicity, and language data for their applicants so that they can judge how best to match their volunteers to different sites. And in general, the volunteers are matched to sites based on ethnic background or language skills. All of the volunteers receive a mandatory cultural competence training, and they also get feedback on cultural competence as part of their reviews and just ongoing supports around these issues from their managers. So as a result of this work, now Family Van, about 50% of their staff members come from the specific neighborhoods that they serve with their vans. 50% of the staff members are minorities, and 40% of the volunteers are as well. And their staff team as a whole speaks 10 languages, and the volunteers speak 16, which again are aligned with the languages spoken by their patients. They've also been successful at reaching and retaining their minority clients. They consistently have about 80 to 90% minority clients that do return to the van. And they've found that over half of their regular clients that have had high blood pressure, high cholesterol, or high blood glucose at their first visit to the van were able to get it under control by their most recent visit. So some of the best practices that have come from this work are first to do what you can to hire staff from the specific communities that you're serving or staff who match clients' ethnic and language groups, because this can really help build trust between staff and clients and overcome trust barriers. Also make diversity a priority during the hiring process so that it's always something that's thought about and considered. For small organizations, it can be really helpful to use a volunteer pool to increase the diversity of your workforce, especially if there aren't very many full-time openings. This can be a way to really supplement your staff pool. And then finally, in addition to just really hiring diverse members of your staff, make sure that the staff as a whole receive ongoing training, discussion, and supports around class so that they can really be providing high-quality care to all the different patients or clients that you might be serving. The final case study comes from the Men's Health League, which is a program in Cambridge, Massachusetts that's targeted at men of color. For this particular initiative that I'm going to be talking about, the Men's Health League partnered with the Cambridge Community Engagement Team, or CET, which is a multi-agency collaborative in Cambridge. And the motivation for this work was that CET found that American-born black community members were underutilizing services, and they wanted to understand why. So working with the Men's Health League, they implemented a two-part initiative that really addresses class standard 13, just to partner with the community to design, implement, and evaluate policies, practices, and services to ensure cultural and linguistic appropriateness. The first part of this initiative was doing some focus groups with American-born black residents of Cambridge to really understand some of the reasons why this population in particular might be underutilizing services. They held three focus groups with this population of Cambridge residents. The focus groups were facilitated by American-born black members of the community engagement team. And the discussion really focused on the needs of this population, the programs that they were utilizing and weren't utilizing, and ideas for improvement. And coming out of these focus group discussions, one of the big themes was that institutional racism was one of the major reasons why this population in particular was underutilizing services. So to try and address this, the next step of this initiative, CET with the Men's Health League held a series of community forums on institutional racism that they called Shine a Light on It. And the goals of this were first to raise awareness about this issue among service providers and help these providers understand how they could make their agencies more welcoming to this population. They held 4 community forums. They were very structured, very interactive, with a strong emphasis on dialogue in small groups. To both plan and lead these forums, they hired outside facilitators, and the main audience that attended were service providers from a range of different community agencies. They had a really high turnout at these events with about 100 attendees at each one. And as a result of these forums, there are 2 community coalitions in Cambridge that focus on children's needs that are now really interested in addressing institutional racism as part of their ongoing work. I also just want to share a couple results from the evaluation of one of these forums. First, almost every attendee agreed that the event gave them insight on how to better meet the needs of the populations they serve. And about 3/4 agreed that the event changed their thinking about their agency's practices. It's kind of summed up in this quote. "This event helped me to think more clearly and deeply about my own assumptions and hidden prejudices. It helped me to ask questions at my agency whenever we're dealing with cross-cultural communication." So the best practices that come from this work are, first, how important it is to take the time to listen to community members and understand their concerns. This can really help focus your work and bring to the table what the most important issues are. In this particular case, with a sensitive topic like institutional racism, it was really helpful to use experienced outside facilitators. It kind of created an open and safe environment in which participants could be open to learning and having discussions. It's also important to, if you're interested in tackling an issue as big as this, to really start by building a common language and common understanding of the issue. Everyone has to be able to have a conversation at the same level before we can really start thinking about taking action. Next, to address issues like institutional racism, it's really necessary to commit to ongoing events, efforts or events. One single initiative or one event just isn't enough to really tackle something so big. And then finally, if possible, promote multi-agency collaboration. This can just be more effective than a single organization trying to deal with this issue on their own. Just multiple agencies working together can really help mobilize resources, build momentum, and just have a bigger reach at the end. So I just want to conclude with some common themes among the 3 case studies. First, all 3 of these organizations have really made class a really high priority at all levels of their organization, from the staff that are on the ground up to senior leadership. This can take a while to happen, and it might start with 1 or 2 champions that kind of help build the support at your organization, but once it happens, it can be really critical to making this work a success. Next, these 3 programs have really worked to engage their communities and learn about the people that they're serving in a really in-depth way that's really helped guide their work and make sure that everything they're doing is really meeting the needs of the populations they serve. And then finally, these 3 programs have also all committed to ongoing efforts that have really allowed them to continuously grow and improve the services that they're offering. So I'd just like to thank the 3 grantees that helped me put together this presentation, and thank you all for your attention as well.